It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. So most of you probably know at least the basics by now of the current uprising in Iran. A 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini was detained by police for improper wearing of a headscarf and then died in police custody. There has since been unrest in many places around that country. State media says 41 people have been killed, including protesters and police. The BBC quotes a human rights group saying more than 70 protesters have been killed. Just this morning, just a little while ago, as the BBC reports, Iran's president warned that he will not accept chaos, he used the word chaos, as authorities continue to crack down on protests, which also means that after many days already, the protests are continuing and the issue of women's rights is not simply dying down. With us now is someone with personal experience with Iran's so-called morality police. She is Pardis Madavi, an Iranian-American who is provost of the University of Montana and author of the book Passionate Uprisings, Iran's Sexual Revolution. She also wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post this week, maybe some of you have seen it, called When Iran's Morality Police Came for Me. We'll hear that story. Provost Madavi, thanks very much for joining us at this intense moment and potential turning point in history, I dare say. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us a little about yourself first for some context for our listeners? We don't usually say Iran and Montana in the same breath.
That's absolutely right. I am an Iranian American. My parents fled Iran during the revolution, and I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, grew up in Southern California. We moved there in the 1980s after my father faced some incidents of xenophobia during the Iran hostage crisis in Minnesota. So I grew up mostly in Southern California, where there are far more Iranians. I grew up just outside of what we call Tehrangeles or Los Angeles. I then pursued a course of study. I pursued diplomacy and world affairs initially because I wanted to be the bridge between my two home countries, Iran and America. After finishing my undergraduate work, I then went on to Columbia University to pursue a master's in international affairs. And then began writing stories about Iranian youth. I traveled back to Iran in the late 90s and was fascinated to note that not only was there, you know, a burgeoning feminist movement, but I started engaging with young people who were, you know, at the time, my age, we were all children of the revolution, all born 1978, 79, 1980. And these young people were engaging in what they called a sexual revolution, or Enghelab Jinsi in Persian. And I became fascinated by this youth movement where young people were speaking back to a regime that had come to power under a fabric of morality by using their own bodies to gradually chip away at that morality framework. I became absolutely fascinated by this movement and inspired by the work they were doing, and returned to Columbia, decided to pursue actually my PhD in anthropology, in medical anthropology, because I wanted to study the intersections of sexuality and politics. And back in the early 2000s, that was the only way to do it. I pursued my PhD. I did dissertation field work in Iran. So I basically spent more of my time in Iran between 1999 and 2007 than I did in the United States. I was doing on the ground research on Iran's sexual revolution, and then wrote my first book, which was Passionate Uprisings, Iran's Sexual Revolution. And that book, of course, got me into a bit of hot water in 2007. When I was presenting the preliminary results of my fieldwork at Tehran University, and 13 minutes into my lecture, the auditorium doors banged open. the morality police came stomping in and pulled me off stage.
And that's where your article begins. And I want to, of course, get into the details of that story and how it relates to what's going on right now, today, in Iran. But let me back you up just a couple of steps, because you just told such a fascinating story of your own journey, which took you from being born in Minnesota to being provost in Montana via Los Angeles, Tehrangeles, as you called it, and New York. Were you old enough in Minnesota before your parents felt that they were forced to flee to L.A. To experience any kind of irony around the fact that all of America was outraged by the hostage-taking of Americans by the new Iranian regime at that time in 1979, the same regime that your parents had fled because they would have been oppressed by them, but then other Americans were turning on you and associating you with the regime that your family fled.
Absolutely, Brian. And, you know, I was old enough. I was in elementary school and I came home from school one day and there was a sign that was posted in front of my house and it said, "Burn this house. Terrorists live here." And my first instinct was, oh, have terrorists come to my house? Who are they talking about? My father was a physician. My mom worked at the hospital. And my understanding, you know, an elementary school girl's understanding was my parents were trying to help people. And they were fleeing a regime that they described as being terrorists. And so I was incredibly saddened and terrified when I saw that sign. And it was that night that my father decided that we needed to move to California. And my father said something to me in that move, which perhaps helps to connect the dots as to how I end up in Montana. My father said something to me as we moved from Minneapolis to California. He said, "You know, Pardis, people can take everything from you. They can take your home, they can take your belongings, they can even take your country. But the one thing no one can ever take from you is your education." Hmm. And that stayed with me and is what prompted me to not only pursue education with a relentless passion, but also, you know, to about, you know, a decade into my career as a professor, to become a leader in academia, to become a dean and then a provost, because I wanted to help others get that which can never be taken away from them, which is an education. So, you know, that move was transformative. Yeah.
And now, listeners, we're going to invite you in on this pretty early on here. We took some calls from Iranian Americans on what's going on in Iran right now last week. We invite more of you now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What's the issue in Iran as you see it, driving people into the streets? How do you want this to end or think this will end? One of the points of Pardis's op-ed, as we'll get to, is that she thinks this may end differently, maybe better than the wave of protests in 2018 that did fade away. Listeners, what can Iranian Americans do? There's another question for you. 212-433-WNYC or anything else you want to say or questions for our guest, Pardis Mahlavi, provost of the University of Montana and author of the book Passionate Uprisings, Iran's Sexual Revolution, and the op-ed in the Washington Post called When Iran's Morality Police Came for Me. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet a question or a comment for Pardis Mahlavi, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. So the first line of your article is, "The morality police came for me exactly 13 minutes into my lecture on gender and sexual politics in post-revolutionary Iran." So you started to tell this story a minute ago. Tell us more. Where and when exactly were you giving that lecture?
Yeah, it was the summer of 2007, and I was in Tehran. And I was just putting the finishing touches after 8 years of on-the-ground ethnographic fieldwork in cities including Tehran, Shiraz, Esfahan and Mashhad, where my father's family lives. I had done 8 years of on-the-ground fieldwork following what young people described as Iran's sexual revolution, and actually had been writing quite a lot about the morality police, and really thinking about how this sexual revolution could lead to a civil rights type movement. And we saw that just a few years later in 2009 in the Green Movement. And of course, that's what we're seeing on the streets of Iran today. But to back up to that, very pivotal moment in my own life, I was just beginning to share the results of my research. My interlocutors and my friends, my family were quite adamant, and I agreed that I should present the results of the research in Iran. That was the right thing to do. And I should note here, Brian, that I began my research under President Khatami, a much more reformist, progressive ruler. And when I first started doing my field work, I had the opportunity to work with the Ministry of Education, with the Ministry of Health. And I had quite a lot of freedom of movement. By 2007, of course, as you know, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad had been elected a few years prior, and things had started to turn. And, as I look back on the decision to present my research in Tehran in 07, I do, of course, the Monday morning quarterbacking, I do ask myself, what was I thinking? Why did I think I could present the results? But I also wanted to be fair and true to those who had opened up their hearts and their stories to me at great risk to themselves. So
it sounds like you knew you were putting yourself in some kind of danger by even giving that lecture.
Absolutely. I did. And yet, Brian, if you were to ask me, would I do it again? Would I still publish that book? Would I still say what I said and write what I wrote? Absolutely, I would. I think it was
the auditorium doors swung open, you're right. And
I can't remember if I saw or smelled or heard them first, but I can still remember the sound of boots clanking. And a whole different, sensory. The auditorium had smelled like rosin and rose water, and suddenly it erupted in all different types of scents. And pandemonium ensued. And I should have been shredding my lecture notes. That's what I should have been doing. But I was frozen, just gripping the podium until a few of them walked up, the four stairs up to the stage and pulled me off. And then I blacked out.
So you were either knocked unconscious or out of fear and anxiety or whatever, you blacked out. How hurt were you?
Not physically. And this is what I often underscore. People say, well, were you hurt physically? No. I think in my case, it was much more emotional. And I always say, and I will say it again, I was one of the lucky ones. My friend and colleague, Hala Isfandiari, had been arrested that same summer, and she was held in Evin prison in solitary for months and months and months. And she faced far more, brutality at the hands of the interrogators and torturers in Evin. So I do consider myself one of the lucky ones, Brian. I think it's important that I say that.
In your op-ed, you called the men who detained you thugs. Were they official agents of the government?
So I think this is what's interesting. The government has several different arms of the police. And so when the Islamist regime came to power, they replaced what they had been critiquing as the brutal Savak police under the Shah. They replaced their police with a number of different arms. One was the Revolutionary Guard. And I think that's who most people outside of Iran are familiar with, is the Revolutionary Guard. But they also created another arm, and that was the Morality Police. And the Morality Police are charged with, and here's the technical definition, they're charged with committing right and forbidding wrongs. Okay. And their charge is to ensure that the morality of the population of Iran is upheld by, for example, policing what women wear. Are they wearing proper Islamic outerwear. And I would actually say, Brian, that it's not just women. They also police men. So, you know, young men who were seen with, you know, eye-catching hairstyles, mohawks or faux hawks, you know, these young men were also police, people who, you know, people who had eye-catching jewelry and accessories. They also walked the streets looking for unmarried couples who might be engaging in immoral behavior, holding hands, making out in the park. And then eventually, you know, they disguised as plainclothesmen and would often raid parties and raves and, you know, various immoral, you know, quote unquote, immoral
quote
gatherings.
Unquote, yeah.
Yes,
morality
that
is a big
charge.
Word. The morality
yes.
police. Morality is a big word. I mean, not detaining a peaceful person giving an academic lecture. Not detaining that person could be seen as a moral standard to uphold. So the realms of morality that the morality police, mostly police, seem to all have to do with sex and gender and physical expression.
Absolutely. And also I would say, you know, alcohol use, playing music too loud. I mean, I saw young people in the early 2000s, you know, if young group of young people were, you know, speeding down the streets of Tehran, blaring their music, I saw them being pulled over. And so, you know, one of the quotes from my article where I quote a Khomeini quote that was presented on billboards in Tehran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, when he came to power, he said, there is no fun to be had in the Islamic Republic. And so, in a sense, the morality police are there to sort of patrol that notion of fun, which, of course, you and I might interpret in a number of different ways. But remember, Brian, that this is a regime that came to power in the late 70s and early 80s. They came to power on a platform of fighting what they saw as an over-infatuation with the West, or what they call West toxication. So this regime came to power juxtaposing themselves, and they came to power under a fabric of morality, promising to return Iran to an old concept of Iranianness. So the morality police were the enforcers of that.
They seem to have done a pretty good job of, well, they accused you of trying to foment a revolution. They seem to have done a pretty good job of fomenting a revolution themselves with the death of Mahsa Amini. Are you surprised by the intensity or duration of the reaction? You note in your op-ed that Iranians have taken to the streets now in more than 40 cities.
Yep, and actually that's even growing. Last night I heard it was over 50 cities. Huh. I think that it is different this time. I do think it's different. I think that, you know, and what we saw and, you know, you saw the Green Movement in 2009, you know, people rallying also around the very tragic death of Nida Sultan. And, you know, we've seen protests, but each time we've seen protests erupting in the street, I would say since 2009, the support has increased. And so I think what's important to note this time is, what we're seeing today, it's no longer just a women's rights issue. It's no longer just a quote unquote feminist issue. People are in the streets fighting for human rights, fighting for their freedom and their dignity. And they're in the streets speaking out against a regime that they feel does not represent them.
Let's take a phone call. Mondana in Westchester. You're on WNYC with the provost of the University of Montana, Pardis Madavi. Mondana, am I saying your name right?
Yes. Yes, correct. Hi, Brian. Hi, Pardis. Thanks for having me. I want to start with answering one of your questions, and then we get to the other question. You mm-hmm. asked what the fellow Americans can do. I want to say to my fellow Americans, I need you to email, call your senators and representatives, ask them to cut diplomatic ties with this terrorist regime of Islamic Republic. U.S. is a leader, so this time they should act as a leader and be the first one to cut ties, diplomatic ties. That will show that the United States is supporting this freedom movement, this revolution that people are, it's happening in Iran. Please do that.
Can I ask you a follow-up?
One thing I can guarantee my fellow Americans.
Go ahead, Mandana.
Let me just one more sentence. One more thing that I can promise my fellow American is that the free Iran, Democratic Republic of Iran, will open doors to Atomic Energy Agency personnel to come in and inspect and remove whatever nuclear stuff is there. Mm-hmm. And Iranian people do not want atomic one. We don't want any of that. So that would be one of the first things that is going to happen. So my fellow American, we don't need to keep this government, terrorist government, to negotiate with them. We can get rid of them. Just stand on the side of the people, and we will have. You will not have to worry about an atomic bomb in Middle East.
So you would say, while this struggle for human rights is going on there, no nuclear agreement with Iran. That's what you're saying, right?
I am saying exactly, no negotiations. They are not legitimate government. The last election, only 3% of the people voted for this president who came to the United Nations a few weeks ago. 3% of the people do not represent the entire country of 86 million people. This government is not a legitimate government. Biden administration should not have been negotiating with an illegitimate government to start with. So that now that people want to change the government, it's another saying that this is illegitimate. This government is not representing us. Don't negotiate with them.
Mandana, thank you so much. Please call us again. Well, there's a dilemma, Pardis. If you ask progressives in this country generally, are you for women's rights and against headscarf laws and all of that? Obviously, yes. And if you ask, are you for re-entering a nuclear weapons agreement with Iran that Trump pulled us out of, they probably would also say yes for the most part. For that listener, at least, Iranian American, the two things clash. What about for you?
You know, I'm actually glad that Mandana brought that up, and thank you for calling us. You know, it is interesting to think about the fact that, yes, that there have been these ongoing conversations. Now, of course, we've seen examples in the past historically, you know, during the Cold War, were governments still, you know, engaging in some negotiations with Russia? Yes. But I think that Mandana has a really good point that, you know, there may be a time for those negotiations. This is not that time, right? Now the time is for the United States and the world to stand with the people of Iran. And so, you know, it's not to say that we don't have to worry about the nuclear issue. But I think that now is the time for us to focus on the people and how we can support the people of Iran at this absolutely pivotal moment.
When you gave your speech in 2007 that got you arrested by the morality police, they accused you, as you write in your op-ed, of fomenting a revolution. Sounds from Mandana's call like she wants to foment a revolution. There should be a revolution. This government should be overthrown and replaced with a whole new kind of governance structure in Iran. Is that the goal? Is that your goal? Is that the protesters' goals?
I mean, I think it's very clearly the protesters' goals. They've been, you know, and I think they've been articulating that since, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And so that is what I want to underscore here, Brian, is that there's been a groundswell of movement. And the sexual revolution that I was studying, you know, between 1999 and 2007, that social movement sowed the seeds of reform. And then we saw, you know, the green movement allowed those to take root. And then today we're seeing the fruits of that movement. So it's been, you know, more than two decades that the protests, the people, you know, pouring into the streets of Iran, they have been speaking out against the regime and calling for their removal. And now their voices are just getting louder and more amplified because they have more and more support. Whereas before it was maybe seen as, okay, maybe this is a movement initiated by young people or people who are in the urban centers or people of a certain class or people of a certain, you know, religious affiliation. Today it's widespread, and you see Iranians from all parts of the country frustrated with the regime that they believe has not had their best interests at heart, that has not focused on issues such as infrastructure and employment, has resulted in these crippling sanctions, really harming the people of Iran. So yes, I would say the folks in the street are very passionate and risking their lives, demanding freedom.
We'll continue in a minute with Pardis Madavi, author of, among other things, the Washington Post op-ed, When Iran's Morality Police Came for Me, and more of your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with the provost of the University of Montana. And if you're just joining us, you may be surprised to hear that title since we're talking about Iran and Iranian Americans. It's Pardis Madavi, an Iranian American who is provost of the University of Montana and author of the book Passionate Uprisings, Iran's Sexual Revolution. She also wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post called When Iran's Morality Police Came for Me. Pardis, I want to read a tweet that we got from a listener. It's a question for you. It says, may I ask the professor if she sees any parallels between the theocracy of Iran and the surge of Christian nationalism here in the USA? Are there any similarities or differences that may be used in order to restore and preserve the separation of church and state? Or I guess in that case, mosque and state.
I mean, I think that's a great question and one that we've been asking, I would say, even since, George W. Bush's presidency here, where we saw in the United States a kind of a strange bedfellows alliance of evangelical Christians, right, with different types of political groups. And, when that administration, enacted the global gag rule, which essentially, prohibited U.S. funding to support any organizations doing, work on around family planning, basically sex education, there were striking parallels between that and what the Iranian regime was passing, which actually, forbade, let's say, radio hosts from saying the word condom on the radio. Strong parallels there. And so that's something that we have been seeing for the last 20 years. Absolutely.
Let's take another phone call. Tara in Pennington, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Tara.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I'm calling, even though I'm here, but all my family are in Iran. So we are feeling that and we are with the people of Iran. So my brothers every night go to the street and they know and they feel the fear. I'm sorry, I've been so emotional.
I know it's emotional,
but
obviously.
I just wanted to say.
It's okay.
But I want just to say, we want to get rid of this regime. Middle East and the whole world will be a safer place without these terrorist people. We want Western countries to stop negotiating with these people. These are not representative of our people. They have to call the ambassadors from my country. They have to close the embassies in my country. They have to cut all the ties with this terrorist group. We want to get rid of them. And we will stay to end.
How, Tara? How will that regime be toppled?
When people are saying the street, they voice at the end of it, no matter how long does it take, even Gandhi was one person and started the movement. If we stay together, we will get rid of this government. It's not going to be easy. They kill so many people, they will kill more. But if we stay together, if we have support from Western countries, if human rights is really matters for Western countries, then this movement will get to the end.
Pardis,
there is no other choice.
Do you want to talk to Tara at all or ask her any questions?
Absolutely. Hi, Tara June. Thank you so much for calling in. I can absolutely hear the pain in your voice, and I want you to know it resonates with me. I think, so many Iranian Americans, like myself, like my parents, they have been hoping for 44 years now that this regime will somehow be removed so we can go home. so we can go see our families. And Tara, I don't know about you, but you know, in my case, especially in the last 3 years when COVID hit Iran so hard, and I've lost family members, and I can't go back to their, I can't go home for their funeral. We can't go home. And so I know that part of the pain in your voice is the pain of exile. And I want to say that that's something that, that I feel too.
Do you want to say any last
thing,
Tara?
Thank you. Yes, please continue and be our voice. You know that there is no internet connection. Please be our voice. Let other people hear our voice and let them know that we are not alone in this
Tara.
Movement to freedom, to justice and democracy.
Thank you
Absolutely.
So much. And thank you for sharing your voice on this show. And this is why we take callers, folks, right? This is why we don't just talk to experts and journalists and academics, even though our guest is an academic. She also has the personal experience, as described in her article, When Iran's Morality Police Came for Me. We get to hear people's lived experiences, like Tara's from Pennington. And it's much better that way. And it's yeah. you know, much more real. So to what she was talking about, the last line of your op-ed is, no country, no matter how long it tries, can repress its citizens forever. What gives you hope that this will change, and how?
You know, Brian, I think that what we're seeing now, one of the things that's giving me so much hope is the fact that the international community is speaking about it, is talking about it. You and I are here this morning talking about it. We have callers calling in, thanking you for amplifying their voices. You know, when I started working on the youth movements and the protests, you know, young women like Mahsa Amini were being pulled off the streets and, you know, threatened and hurt by the morality police. And it wouldn't even make the papers, you know, outside of Iran. Rarely would it make the papers inside of Iran because the press is so tightly controlled, right? And now we're in this different moment where Mahsa Amini's name is known throughout the world. And everyone is, you know, more and more people around the globe are looking at Iran, are talking about Iran, and are saying, we stand with you. That the attention of the international community is what gives me hope, Brian. The fact that you and I are having this conversation today, that gives me hope.
Why do you think her case broke out when so many others, presumably like it, did not?
You know, I think some of it is timing. You know, at a certain point, people are fed, they've had enough, right? At a certain point, people will say enough is enough. And you know, we see that here in the United States with the movement for Black Lives, right? At a certain point, people will say enough is enough. And you know, a death captured on video and shared around the world is a call to action, just as we've seen here in this country. It's a catalyzing moment for civil rights. I also think Mahsa's case was incredibly chilling, not unlike many of the cases we've seen here in the United States. She was not out there, you know, actively trying to protest and foment a velvet revolution as many others, you know, as I was accused of doing, as many others have been. She was walking the streets and her headscarf was not properly positioned. I mean, when you talk about somebody who, you know, the brutality of what she faced, given that she was walking the streets with a headscarf that was, quote unquote, immorally placed, how can you argue that that is absolute brutality? How can you argue with that?
Scheherazade in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Scheherazade.
Okay, guys. I just wanted to say, I kind of wanted to respond to some of the callers that were calling in. I like totally agree with what everyone's saying about the government. They are truly the worst. And I'm like really hopeful that maybe this is the like straw that breaks the camel's back in Iran. But I just get concerned when people call in saying, like, we shouldn't be negotiating with these people. You know, they're essentially being like, they're terrorists, we shouldn't negotiate with them, they're awful, because we haven't been negotiating with them. And in fact, like, the whole problem is that we haven't been negotiating with them. I think that had we come to an agreement with the Iranian regime during Trump's time, we actually would have had a nuclear deal. We would have maybe had a progressive president in Iran instead of Raisi. And none of this, potentially this wouldn't be happening. It would be like a more progressive place, and America would be helping by talking to them and opening those lines of communication. I think by like shutting them out, we've seen what happens. The sanctions are hurting the Iranian people. It's not the Iranian government that's getting hurt. And the sanctions are hurting their health care. I mean, people can't get medication. It's like really sad. So I don't like to hear Iranian callers saying like, let's not negotiate, let's cut these people off. I don't think that's helpful to the people, actually.
I hear you, Pardis. Well, there's the tension. What are you thinking as you listen to Scheherazade?
You know, Scheherazade, I absolutely, you know, I think you make a really strong point, which is, I don't think we want to call Iranians, you know, terror. We don't want to feed Islamophobia, certainly. And I think that, you know, one of the things I was arguing before was, had we engaged in conversations with more moderate presidents like Khatami or like, you know, Rouhani, who was president before Raisi, had we taken that opportunity to start to engage in conversations, to start to strengthen a more, you know, moderate side, I mean, that may have opened up space for the international community to, you know, to invite Iran in, to start to do a lot of because wonderful human rights work is being done in Iran. You've got a very vibrant civil society. You've got very strong, you know, a very strong presence of activism, as we're seeing that has spilled out into the streets in this way today. But I do think that, you know, that we may have missed some opportunities to negotiate with moderates such as Khatami or Rouhani before we ended up with hardliners like Ahmadinejad and Raisi. So I think that is a very fair point.
One more listener comment, then we're out of time. This one on Twitter. Listener writes, protests in Iran changed the corrupt rule of the Shah, so these protests could change the rule of these religious zealots. You agree? Can the government be brought down? Can democracy be established in Iran through mostly peaceful protests in the streets, if they're big enough?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is why some of us are cautiously optimistic at this moment. And I think that, you know, while some may have initially thought, you know, that what we saw in the protests on the streets of Iran in these last several days resembled the protests of 2018, I actually would argue that it does remind me more of 1978 and 1979. The fervor, the numbers, the widespread nature of these protests does have a pretty strong echo of the revolution that ousted the Shah. So I think that is cause for us looking at things differently, and it is cause for hope.
Perhaps at a turning point in history, we thank Pardis Madhavi, provost of the University of Montana and author of the book Passionate Uprisings, Iran's Sexual Revolution. And maybe you saw her recent op-ed in the Washington Post called When Iran's Morality Police Came for Me. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.